The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of drugwarfacts.org. This week, my guest is Keith Brown. Keith is the director of health and harm reduction at the Catal Center for Health, Equity, and Justice. Now, I've got so many questions I want to ask you. You've done work in the law enforcement assisted diversion. You were a project director of an initiative in Albany. And of course, LEAD is something we've talked about quite a lot on the show. Where I live here in the Portland, Oregon area, there are LEAD programs operating in Portland. They're trying to do something out here where I live in Clackamas County. But the reason I asked you on is this article you wrote recently at Filter Magazine, filtermag.org. Three recent stories illustrate the media's ongoing drug war propaganda. Tell me about your story.
Well, as you said, you know, this has been going on, you know, during the whole duration of what we call the war on drugs. And when we historically or even currently think about, you know, where those fronts are, I guess if we use the war analogy and build it out, we think of law enforcement and in many cases, right, we think of the military, especially in our geopolitical involvement in the war on drugs. But there's a lot of other actors that I think we don't pay attention to enough. I think the media is a primary one, which was really the focus of this piece I wrote. And you know, we also need to think more about, you know, what the role of elected officials. We obviously know what that looks like, but then also what is the role of the nonprofit industrial complex in the war on drugs, and what is the role of the child welfare system and all these other actors there. And so, you know, that's sort of a discussion for another time. But when we specifically think about the media, I wrote this piece because I think I had really sort of had enough of a specific cycle of these stories. And several of them were centered around this myth of law enforcement, overdosing on fentanyl when they respond to overdose scenes or when they're doing traffic stops or other things. And then this phenomenon happened when this story hit New York State and then really went national about marijuana that was seized, that field tested positive for fentanyl. And I sort of knew, or at least suspected, how this story was gonna play out. And so for me, it was very difficult because as soon as the story hit, people were blowing up my phone and my email and you know, sharing it with me on Facebook and Twitter and all the different platforms saying, you know, what's the deal with this, Keith? You know, is this true? You know, that was half of the responses. And the other half was, you know, people being really glib saying, you know, see this, you know, this is happening and you've been telling us this isn't really true. And I had to sort of bide my time, and I did something that's very difficult for me, which was nothing for a little while, and waited until the responses, you know, actually started to come in once this stuff played out. And usually what happens is when something occurs like that, this is not news to you, but, you know, something gets seized. If it field tests positive for fentanyl and, you know, that's going to proceed in certain ways, that has to go to the lab for confirmatory testing. And what then happened was my email and my text messages started coming in again, and they were from people who I know in various capacities, sources, if you will, that were saying to me, hey, FYI, the lab results came back and this weed tested negative for fentanyl. And so I immediately said, well, I have to start telling people this, and we have to figure out a way of communicating this, because there's not a chance that the media is going to come out and correct this or retract it or otherwise do anything about it. And sure enough, I have yet to see a single story from any news outlets, really, I think, besides maybe the article that I wrote, that actually says that the follow-up on this said that, yeah, in fact, it tested negative for fentanyl. And then, you know, the same thing keeps happening with these law enforcement contact stories. It's the same story every time. The officer develops symptoms and has to either be Narcan'd or, you know, just barely gets themselves to the hospital, and all of these stories. And then when the blood work comes back on the officer, you know, typically the department or the sheriff's department where it happened said, you know, well, we can't release that information, which we know it showed that there was no fentanyl likely in the officer's blood, but also that in many cases, the actual drugs that they sent for confirmatory testing turned out testing negative for fentanyl and other analogs. So, you know, this was the thing for me that was the impetus of this article, and we have to hold the media accountable to, you know, for their role in perpetuating myths about drugs, stigma around people who use drugs, pro-law enforcement angles on these things, because they are an arm of the war on drugs that we need to reckon with.
Now, of course, in your article, you also point out this is not new. I mean, I'm talking about the 1980s when I introduce you, and you know, it obviously went on well before then. I mean, there's not a marijuana activist in the country or practically in the world who couldn't tell you about the Hearst newspapers and the propaganda campaign that was waged by Harry Anslinger. And I guess you could even go back further, right? Because you've got Dr. Hamilton Wright, I think was his name, the opium commissioner who helped to start the panic about opioids in the beginning of the 20th century in the U.S. But people would rather hear you talk about this. Tell me about the history of how this has gone on for a long time.
Yeah, since the beginning of our drug laws, you don't get these policies and you don't get these laws and major enforcement efforts without the narrative being driven to the general public to generate support for it. And so when you look at, like you said, I mean, from the beginning of these laws back to, you know, opium and you know, Chinese laborers out west, and then you can literally draw a line through all of these narratives, and then you talk about black men working as porters in cocaine, and you know, cannabis with jazz musicians, and crack with super predators. And here's a prime example. Let's talk about crack babies for a second. I mean, you and I have been around long enough, and been doing this work long enough to remember that the narrative around crack was that we were going to have a generation of people that were going to be lost, and that they were not going to amount to anything, and that they were going to be system involved and on welfare and in jails and prisons and also using drugs themselves. And it was, you know, incredibly, you know, misogynistic in how it attacked women who use drugs. And you saw all this footage on TV of these babies that would, you know, be these little skinny things in, you know, in incubators, and it was all untrue. And yet, if you ask rooms full of people, I've just been doing a series of trainings, and I ask people about what they know about crack babies, and everybody says the same thing. If you're old enough to remember, this is what crack babies are. This is what the situation is with them. And then I say, has anyone seen a story about crack babies or any of the research on those people now? And nobody has. Nobody has. Everybody knows what the term means and what it's referring to. And nobody knows that the research actually shows that if you adjust for poverty, those people that were born, right, to mothers who were using crack had no worse outcomes when compared with people in a similar socioeconomic bracket. Again, adjusting for poverty, which says literally the issue is poverty, not drug use. And yet we're still driving this narrative that it must in some way have to do with drugs. So this is, you have to know the history on this. And you also, to be really, you know, blunt about it, once you become aware of how things are being communicated, you can sort of see the future on this already. And I can tell you that the future, in terms of whatever kinder, gentler war on drugs we're having right now, doesn't look good. And it's happening right now around fentanyl. And the narrative around fentanyl is you were creating a boogeyman around fentanyl like we did with crack cocaine. and we're carving it out as this separate thing from other opioids. Fentanyl is showing up in the vast majority of heroin supply in this country. I mean, the last I've heard, it's like it's hard to find a bag of heroin anywhere, especially in the East Coast, that doesn't have fentanyl in it. And that's just from what I know from people that, you know, people that I talk to. And so when you now are doing this thing by saying it's dangerous to law enforcement, a couple of grains will kill you. You know, the media portrays this as, you know, they show a vial of carfentanil and say, you know, this is enough to kill everybody in Cleveland or something. It's like, we have to understand what's happening here. What's happening is law enforcement and the media are driving a narrative around fentanyl. They're trying to now schedule it in some places and increase penalties on it. And we know where this is leading. It's going to be crack versus powder cocaine all over again. And it's going to be selectively enforced. And it's going to disproportionately impact people living in poverty and communities of color. And when you can see it happening, and it's happening in real time, that was really one of the reasons that really, you know, spurred my writing of this piece. And one of the things I want to do next is write the follow-up piece, which is, what are they setting up here? Like, what is happening here? Like, what do we need to be aware of? Because it's going on as we speak.
This is an interview with Keith Brown, Director of Health and Harm Reduction at the Cattell Center for Health, Equity, and Social Justice. We'll hear more in a moment. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of drugwarfacts.org. Now let's get back to that interview. For myself, I'm, you know, what can I be doing? I've got this radio show. Goes out every week. I do some other radio work. I talk about drug policy reform and the war on drugs, right? And now, on the one hand, there is a real concern about fentanyl, as you were saying, it's in the heroin supply all through the East Coast and quite a bit of the rest of the country. But, you know, the approach should be drug safety testing. The approach should be supervised consumption facilities. And in fact, you could have the drug safety testing going on at those facilities. That would save lives. So, you know, how can I reach a balance of communicating the facts and giving, you know, I mean, I think I'm trying for it by giving people an idea of what they can do, you know, not just focusing on the dangers, but also focusing on the kind of positive and sort of intelligent reforms that could actually address this. But what can media do generally?
I think media should be talking about real solutions. I think this is one of the areas where people get fatigued, and I'm seeing it now in practice, where the narrative around how bad the overdose crisis is, right? It's being told in all of these different angles, and people know. People are aware that we're in the midst of something here. People, you know, if you go into rooms full of people, especially younger folks, and say, you know, who knows somebody who has died of an overdose, nearly the entire room will raise their hand. So the impact of this is felt. That said, you know, you still have people in the media describing this as an opioid crisis, and it's not an opioid crisis. We're in an overdose crisis. The opioids are one factor there, fentanyl's one factor there, prescription opioids is one factor there, but, you know, we need to be talking about benzos, and we need to be talking about, you know, gabapentin. We need to be talking about chronic pain patients who are being forced tapered and cut off and sent into the illicit market, and those folks are overdosing, and those folks are committing suicide. You know, stimulants have never gone away. They're in, you know, they're still here. They've never gone away. People are having adverse impacts from stimulants that are leading to drug-related deaths. So I think, number one, we need to frame this as what it is. And it is really a crisis of, you know, what CDC is calling deaths of despair, which you can tie back to social and economic decline in most places. I mean, the fact that you can't work a minimum wage job and afford a one-bedroom apartment in all or almost all, you know, major cities and urban areas in this country, you know, like, that's the narrative. That's what we should be talking about. But, you know, back to your point about the specifics around sort of the drug war stuff, you know, we can be talking about solutions, and we can be really amplifying solutions. You know, when we look at things like, you know, what happened in France in the 90s when they had an HIV and overdose crisis, they made buprenorphine available to anybody who wanted it. That was it. It was a very clear you know, very rational, common sense, health-based approach to what was a health-based issue. They didn't try to arrest their way out of the issue, right? They didn't try to coerce people into anything. They just said, we have a tool available. We know it can help based on the research, and we're just going to make it available. And now I get, you know, France has a different healthcare infrastructure than we do with, you know, with socialized healthcare, and all of that is real. But that still doesn't preclude the U.S. from doing very simple things like, you know, we could have removed the X waiver requirement for buprenorphine years ago. As soon as we realized that it was one of the best tools we had around around people with opioid use disorder, it was should have been thing one, remove the X waiver, remove the prescriber limits on that, get rid of them all together. We should have immediately decriminalized possession of buprenorphine at the street level right off the bat. We should have done that without even thinking about it. We should have created places like safer consumption spaces and drop-in sites immediately, knowing the intersections of the overdose crisis with the rise in homelessness in many places. We should have seen that link coming, you know, a long time ago. So, you know, solutions. We should really be amplifying criminal justice reform. If people are still entering the criminal justice system, then we should be using harm reduction-based mitigation responses to that, like instituting robust medication therapy programs in those facilities using all three, you know, methadone, buprenorphine, and naltrexone in facilities. We know that stuff works. So I think, you know, it's a long answer to your question of what should the media be doing. Is I think the media should really stop talking about what the scope of the problem is without the context of what tools do we have available? What does the research show works? And that's how we need to start framing interventions like decriminalization, safer consumption spaces, ideas that for some people are, you know, might seem different or might seem radical. I think we have to frame those not as radical ideas, but, you know, actually very pragmatic approaches to the issues we have in front of us. You know, if you're having an issue in a community around public consumption of drugs, you know, the answer to that is to provide people who have no place to use those substances with a place to do so. You know, like I enjoy beer, right? I'm a beer drinker. Well, I have a place to live, which means I can consume that substance in a way that doesn't put me in contact with law enforcement. Whereas if I'm homeless or I'm living in a shelter or an SRO, a supportive living environment that doesn't allow me to legally consume a product on premises, then I then have to go to the street to do that, which then means I'm going to be in contact with law enforcement. So I think if we start framing these things as reasonable, pragmatic approaches, it could change a lot about the way we do this. The last thing I'll say about that is, you know, the media is very, the mainstream media, I would say, is very, very caught up on doing this both sidesism thing. And while I think I understand the motivation for it, which is to be able to portray different voices or all voices here, I got to tell you, for some things, we might not need to be doing that. I mean, I think when you look at something like, you know, vaccinations or something where, like, you know, it's like you go out of your way to find somebody who's going to be the fringe or the opposing viewpoint. Sometimes that comes across, you know, it mainstreams ideas that frankly are just not rooted in any type of reality. And when you walk that through with, you know, the overdose crisis or with the war on drugs, you know, sometimes that voice is law enforcement or the DA or somebody else, where you might talk to 10 people and 9 of those people say, like, yeah, we think this idea sounds good. It makes sense. Or they might be public health professionals, say, like, yeah, we've looked at the research. We've done this. You know, we visited other programs. This makes perfect sense. And then they talk to, you know, the DA or the chief of police and they say, I don't like the idea. I think it's just encouraging drug use. And then now that's the narrative that goes out there, not all of the data, not all of the reason it makes pragmatic sense and all of that stuff. And so the other thing, and I know I said that was the last thing, but the real thing that the media needs to stop doing is listening to law enforcement as experts on drugs And this is one where this isn't me saying this. This is feedback I've gotten from reporters and other people that I've worked with. They've told me this is a blind spot. When the police do a press release on something like, you know, an officer, you know, overdoses on fentanyl at a scene, or, you know, marijuana is laced with fentanyl or whatever, they take that press release and they run it. They don't talk to toxicologists. They don't talk to drug policy people. They don't talk to health department people. They don't talk to behavioral health professionals. They don't talk to addiction medicine docs. They just take the story, and because it comes from law enforcement, they take that immediately to mean that that's a trusted expert voice, and they just roll with it. And so that's how the narrative gets out there.
It's incredibly frustrating. I mean, law enforcement shouldn't even be considered experts on criminal justice and law enforcement, for crying out loud. They're certainly not knowledgeable about drugs or drug use. I hear you about the beer thing too, because it's, you know, on my way to the marijuana shop, which is just a block away. I walk through the parking lot and out back of the there's a little convenience store that mostly sells beer, and there are a couple of folks who hang in that parking lot, and they're not people who are unhoused. They're people who live along one of the, possibly in a mobile home, possibly in a sheltered housing that's in the neighborhood, but they're not allowed to have beer on premises. And the bars don't really, you know, they charge too much. So pick up a few from the six-pack store and hang out in the parking lot. It's in our state of Oregon, we're not allowed to use marijuana in public, and we're working to get legal consumption spaces. But if you have your own home, you're fine. If you own your own home, you're fine. If you're a renter like I am, then there will probably be a provision in the lease saying no marijuana use, no marijuana production, no marijuana growing, no anything regarding weed, and which we did. We had to sign that to get here. And you'll eventually get that too, but probably.
Oh, I'm certain of it. Well, you know, here the bill that was proposed, the governor tried to pull the home grow provision out of it. So,
which again is a great thing if you can take advantage of it. But it does. It has that, you know, the I'm not allowed to. It's an evictable offense. So. Now, I hope you have another couple minutes, because I want to ask you a few more things. And one of that is about how can we counteract these negative media images?
Yeah, I think there was just a recent story published, and I think Louise Beale Vincent from the National User Union did it, if I'm not mistaken. But it has to do with how people with privilege need to start coming out as drug users, right? That people need to be, you know, that the way to reduce stigma on people who use certain drugs is for people to have a much different conversation about drug use. And so one of the things I've started including in trainings I do is that when I introduce myself, I will say, you know, I'm a person who uses drugs. And for the room, sometimes that's a, you know, sometimes that's a, immediately people go to like, well, what does he mean? And everybody sort of then says like, well, I wonder what drugs he uses. Oh, he seems like a coke guy, or he seems like, you know, it's like, I think that naturally starts to get people kind of thinking. But then when you talk about, you know, our drug laws and how we don't criminalize substances based on pharmacology, we do it because of who uses them, why, how, right? Politics, power, control, white supremacy, race, class, gender, you know, patriarchy, like all of that stuff is tied up in there. When you start to tease out with people, you know, that caffeine is a drug and alcohol is a drug and, right, prescription drugs are drugs, that we start to talk about psychoactive substances and how as a country, we love drugs. We like U.S., like, we love drugs. What we don't love is people who use drugs. And that's not, and that's to say that it's people who use specific drugs. And that's how we've gotten this far. And that's why when you go to certain other countries and some of their public health interventions are just normalized, and, you know, they don't even use the term harm reduction in some places. They just call it health. It's just health programs. You know, it's like, well, the issue of using drugs is, you know, is also a health issue. And so, you know, we just tie it into our health infrastructure. It's like, that's where we need to get to. We need to destigmatize drug use, we need to start having a real conversation about substances and what does that mean, and the fact that the if you take it at its root definition of, you know, of drugs that or substances that can alter your mood or consciousness, like, we're, you know, most of us are on drugs all the time, whether it be caffeine or nicotine or alcohol or Xanax, or, you know, not even getting into, right, like, people's things that we all, you know, that a lot of people use or that are not legal or quasi-legal. I mean, you're in a state where cannabis is legal. I'm in a state where cannabis is decriminalized, which means that for somebody like me, who's, you know, white and has privilege, like, it's been decriminalized since 1971 or something, basically, in New York State. But it also means that Black and brown communities have been disproportionately impacted during the same time period. You could walk all that through, stop and frisk and all that stuff. So the answer to your question is, like, we have to have a real conversation about drugs as a culture if we're to destigmatize drug use and then go down the line and destigmatize, you know, drugs that are currently illegal, because I believe that stuff changes all the time. I mean, there was a time in our history when, you know, alcohol was an illegal drug. So I think having those conversations with people, doing a bit of history with people so that they can do a little more critical thinking around it, and then normalizing people's experiences around drug use is gonna hopefully get us there. But it's gonna be a lot of work, and so, you know, the media has a lot to do with that. Even our cultural norms have a lot to do with that. I think, you know, when you have people saying things like, you know, is it wine o'clock yet, or is it beer 30? Or, you know, I've even, you know, people have sort of, you know, been like, oh, this week has been whatever, like, I can't wait to take a Xanax and have a glass of wine. It's like, when you can actually have a conversation with people to be like, you know, how different is that really than someone who uses a substance that's illegal to do basically the same thing? You're telling me you're self-medicating yourself. Now, you might not be self-medicating trauma, but you're self-medicating, you know, a week or stress or whatever you're doing. As human beings, we are biologically designed to seek pleasure and avoid pain. That's, you know, that's basically what we do. And so if we can have a real conversation about that, I think we can start disentangling the stigma related to all of that.
That was my interview with Keith Brown. He's the director of health and harm reduction at the Catal Center for Health, Equity, and Justice. Remember, to find out more about Catal Center and the work they're doing, find them on the web at www.catalcenter.org. That's Catal, K-A-T-A-L, center.org. And that's it for this week. I want to thank you for joining us. You have been listening to Century of Lies. We're a production of the Drug Truth Network for the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network, on the web at drugtruth.net. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of drugwarfacts.org. Drug Truth Network programs are all available by podcast. The URLs to subscribe are on the network homepage at drugtruth.net. The Drug Truth Network has a Facebook page. Please give it a like. Drug War Facts is on Facebook, too. Give its page a like and share it with friends. Remember, knowledge is power. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Doug McVeigh, and of course also at Drug Policy Facts. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policy reform and the failed war on drugs. For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long! For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the century of lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.